One, for tearing yourselves away from the football game or soccer game, as your continent dictates. So I'm going to be talking about something that hasn't been mentioned all too much in the talk so far, which is looking at the details of waveforms from binary neutron stars. So this is a source that we are pretty confident about, so it's sort of interesting to look at in that we know we're going to see something from these sources. Well, we expect to see with a single second generation type detector, you expect 1 to 60 a year. Fold in multiple detectors, multiple years, that number amplifies. And that's sort of a SNR8 detection. For most of what I'm going to talk about, what's significant is going beyond detection to something like parameter estimation. And to do that, we're really looking at the strongest signals that advanced LIGO would see. So 10% or 1% of the signals, barring things like being able to combine multiple signals together to get information about what's happening at the end. So here's a sort of a schematic diagram of the canonical system that I'm going to be discussing here. So for neutron stars, I'm putting here 1.35 solar mass. This is for something that's optimally oriented at 100 megaparsecs. And then here you see the sort of noise curves that are for initial LIGO, some proposed noise curves for advanced LIGO in different configurations. These are probably not the initial configuration, but later configurations for advanced LIGO. And then at the bottom here, there's the configuration that you would look at for something like the Einstein telescope or another third generation sensitivity detector. And as you can see, so this is something that you would see strongly in advanced LIGO. And you can sort of divide this into two parts, and well, actually possibly three parts. So this point particle description that I just plotted in the last slide is good for anything relevant for initial LIGO. But for advanced LIGO, you can look at some of the largest neutron stars, which have the most significant contributions from the matter in the system. And you can see some changes in the signal-to-noise ratio that you would measure just looking at the part of the waveform going up to 450 hertz. And we cut this off here because to do this estimate, we're doing a sort of a leading order perturbative kind of estimate of the tidal deformation effect on the waveform. And the approximations are going to be breaking down. So before this, you have a really clean signature, but it's very small, so marginal at best in advanced LIGO. Of course, if you're in something like the Einstein telescope, well, you're probably just reading your signal off the data stream anyway, but you know. So this is sort of the post-Newtonian regime for a binary neutron star signal as it's known today. If you look at numerical simulations, the frequency range where they're relevant for actual detectors is rather high. So again, this is something that's likely not going to be anything significant for advanced LIGO. This is a rare signal that you would see. So most of them are going to be lower amplitude than this. But you see here a bunch of structure at the high frequency. And this total chunk of signal here, covered by numerical simulations, amounts to an SNR of 2 when the full in-spiral was about an SNR of 30 or so in advanced LIGO. And that's in a broadband configuration of advanced LIGO. So this is just to give you an idea of the relevance of binary neutron star simulations, particularly looking at the waveform implications and the detectability implications. So I'm going to sort of divide this talk into three parts. Well, mostly two parts. The two parts, the first two parts would be first talking about how we do this leading order in-spiral calculation. And then the second part, I'm going to talk about the numerical simulations that are available now. And briefly at the end, I'm going to talk a bit about trying to stitch the two regimes together, because If you notice, the region where we're really confident about this perturbative approximation ends before we have robust numerical simulation results, or any numerical simulation results. So there's really a gap here, and if you're trying to accurately track, say, phase through this regime, which is very important if you want to be confident that you're capturing the physics relevant for a waveform signal or injection, you really need to start thinking more about how to connect the two pieces. Okay, so there's a major difference between neutron stars and binary black holes is that you have matter, and that we don't know exactly how this matter behaves. So it's not a fundamental problem of physics. We expect that everything here is well described by standard model physics, but it's a problem of strongly interacting systems that makes it very difficult to decouple, or not decouple, it makes it very difficult to predict how to translate, say, quark degrees of freedom into an actual pressure or density relationship that you would put into your simulation. There's a bunch of candidates, and they each give a different pressure density relationship, and this gives different models for the neutron star structure. So it's pretty common to look at mass radius plots, because this is a good overall summary of the kind of structure you can see, and you can see that there's kind of a large zoo of candidates. But it's possible to start constraining this theoretical uncertainty with astrophysical measurements, and I just wanted to show an example of a way that this has been done, combining a lot of electromagnetic observations, and they're actually getting possibly model dependent. There's two versions of the model in the left and right panels here, but you're starting to actually get significant constraints on the behavior of matter from astrophysics. And also the progress in understanding how to accurately model matter at these high densities and low temperatures, this theoretical understanding is also improving. So it's not like we're only the only player in this game. We have to sort of keep in mind that other people are working on this problem from other kinds of observations too. But yeah, I thought this was a very nice result. Okay, so what's the impact of this uncertain matter on something you would see in a gravitational wave detector? The initial estimates were done. These are at least some of the initial estimates. They're looking at post-Newtonian frameworks and various spheroidal models for the neutron star. And with the perspective of looking for detecting things in initial LIGO, tidal effects don't matter. And these results are still valid, okay? If you're looking at just something where you want up to 3% loss of SNR in initial LIGO frequency band, it would be very unusual or unexpected for something to actually contribute significantly or at all. But for advanced detector configurations, or if you want to sort of understand the systematics of your parameter estimation, these small effects that are negligible for detection may become important. And this is something that you've seen in black holes, the same kind of thing where stuff that didn't matter in the case of detecting things becomes more interesting if you're trying to really nail down the physics and the underlying system. Okay. So let me give a brief overview of how we do the first part of this calculation. So this is the modification of InSpiral for tidal deformation, the leading contribution of matter. And so if you consider a particle in free fall, or even if you consider, say, the movement of the moon around the Earth, they're following along their geodesics, and then they have some perturbation around that from the tidal potential of the other body. And to leading order, this is just going to be a quadrupole mode deformation that can modify the dynamics at formally, well, yes, that can modify the dynamics. And This has been kind of an exciting couple years for making these estimates in the general relativistic case. So you take a perturbative estimate of the tidal deformation for a given mass ratio, a given equation of state, it's sensitive to these three things. And you can get a modification to the whatever waveform you're using, so post-Newtonian, the energy balance equation. And so this was first estimated with the sort of the current technology by Flanagan and Hinderer. And Tanya had some perturbative calculations of polytrope deformabilities. And then in the last year or so, there is sort of an extent of the framework to incorporate higher order deformations of the star and to generalize this to apply to black holes also. And then most recently, this paper that we did with was incorporating these results into updated measurability estimates in advanced detectors and with realistic equations of state. So I'm going to talk a bit about that now. And there's also somewhat parallel work looking at incorporating these sort of things into an EOB framework as the base waveform description. But okay, how do we actually do this? So it turns out that to leading order, you have a single parameter that describes the tidal deformability of a given star. So you look at the star in equilibrium as a TOV solution. You impose some external, you perturb it in the appropriate quadrupole mode. And then you look at the field response far from the star, and you can pick out from the leading order coefficients on the field response something that looks like an external tidal field and something that looks like the induced quadrupole field from the change in the star's matter. So the ratio between those is what we call the tidal deformability, and it's really a measure of deformability in a gravitational potential sense. Okay, this is the effect on the field itself. So it's not actually so sensitive to the surface of the star. It's not leadingly. It's not primarily sensitive to the low density matter at the surface. It's really something that probes the high density matter, because although it's more difficult to deform the high density matter, this is also something where you actually have a chance to make a significant impact on the gravitational potentials. Okay, so you can plot this parameter as a function of mass for an individual star, pretty much in the same way that you would plot radius as a function of mass. And you can just go through any equation of state you want to consider. You can even look at something that's not exactly a neutron star, but a strange star, where you consider this possibility that at very high density, the ground state of matter is just a bag of quarks, sort of like a single nucleon, except enormous. And this gives a different kind of deformability, but also calculable in this framework. And so now you have sort of this number that if you have a particular binary of, say, 2 1.35 solar mass stars, you can characterize the deformation of the star when it's relatively far away by a single number. And so you can put this into your post-Newtonian framework for generating the phase evolution. Okay, so I think probably a lot of you have done some post-Newtonian calculations, and in the adiabatic approximation, you have this sort of leading order energy plus post-Newtonian terms, and the luminosity from the quadrupole acceleration of the system, and you can then add in the additional contributions to both of these things from the quadrupole moment that is induced by the tidal field at that point. And right now, at leading order, you just need the Newtonian tidal field from the point, from the other body at the point you're at. So going beyond that is higher order. And to leading order, these are just known expressions. Okay, and the impact of those then, okay, so you can add this to your waveform. you can look at its Fisher matrix, and well, you vary this parameter as well as the other parameters that describe the system, and you can estimate then, okay, if I have this typical 1.3, 1.4 solar mass system, this dashed line is basically marking out the region of this plot which is invisible to advanced LIGO. So that's a bit disappointing. For any sort of realistic or expected mass range, you're above the level of the kind of tidal deformability that a realistic equation of state gives you. I should have a caveat that this is, of course, scalable with the SNR. This is a plot at an angle average sky distance of 50 megaparsecs, I think. And so if you have a particularly loud signal, you would get something that was lower. And this is a single detector estimate too. So there's plenty of room for these things to move down by like a few or a factor of a few. And the other thing I want to emphasize is we're still sticking below 450 hertz. So this is just really looking at the in-spiral only part of the signal. And then you can also see that if you have something with a sensitivity of a third generation detector, you can really probe this number with actually some sort of idea of making a measurement instead of necessarily just constraining it. Okay. I should mention briefly that this framework, you can have a single number that would describe this leading tidal deformability for an unequal mass binary. So you just have a weighted average of the two tidal deformabilities. And also that when we do these estimates, we're actually doing like something of a real Fisher matrix estimate, where we also see, well, how well with this SNR are we going to be measuring the other parameters, and we're also marginalizing over a range of spins which are expected to be reasonable for neutron stars. So this is all folded into this particular part of the calculation. Okay, so that's that side of things, and then. The next part that I want to talk about is a bit about the status of numerical simulations. So I'm kind of going to focus mostly on the waveforms, but I should mention that when people are doing these numerical simulations of binary neutron stars, gravitational waveforms are not necessarily even the most important thing that they're thinking about, right? So some people are a lot more interested in binary neutron star merger as a potential source for gamma ray bursts, or as some other general astrophysical phenomenon, which you could, you know, if you have strange stars, you can fling little bits of strange matter out into the universe and collapse us all down into some more stable state suddenly. Or if you have, you know, typical neutron stars, you have this idea of, well, like, depending on the initial parameters, do you get a big torus? Can this power some sort of GRB? So the stuff I'm going to talk about is not really a picture of binary neutron star simulations as a whole, but just some results that are relevant from the perspective of learning about the waveform. Okay, so the current status. We have a pretty good length of in-spirals now. There's no instabilities in codes. I mean, binary neutron stars have been running stable codes for longer than black hole in-spirals, simply because we don't have the same kind of horizon instability issues. Okay, so we have the in-spiral. We can do most of the physics that we expect to be relevant for the in-spiral, or that can plausibly be relevant for the in-spiral. Not all of the codes do all of these things, but we can start looking at the range of mass ratios. That's not a problem for neutron stars, partly because we don't expect the mass ratio to be huge. Neutron stars are all about the same mass. We can do full GR. There's also some good results, though, with conformally flat gravity, which especially for resolving the post-merger phase when things are more closer to circular or to spherical is actually probably a very good approximation. We have hydrodynamics that's really doing full hydro. a modeling of the neutron star matter as a perfect fluid moving without viscosity, which is also a good approximation. The viscosity estimates are all orders of magnitude too low. Even when you get some new ones that multiply that by a factor of 100 or so, it's still well beneath the range where you would actually think that viscosity is going to modify the spiral dynamics or lock the stars together or anything like that. We can do fairly arbitrary, realistic cold equations of state, meaning that we're not just doing polytropes, but we have some idea of the transition from electron-supported matter to neutron, well, actually probably not electron-supported, but from the crust of the neutron star to the core of the neutron star, and fairly arbitrary variations of what the core pressure might actually be. There's no fundamental problem in simulating anything like that. And we can also put magnetic fields on the stars and see if, since magnetic fields for some neutron stars are observed to be something on the order of 10 to the 15 Gauss, which you might think could be rather enormous, but given the density scales that we're looking at, the degeneracy pressure of the neutron star matter is actually huge enough that this is a small perturbation. So all these things we can do. And so here are some results of the last kind of year-ish or so. So I'm just focusing on sort of some of the groups that are doing that are actively producing results. There are more codes than this out there, no one else has sort of recently updated the status. So for a sort of a yearly NRDA update, this is some of the stuff to look at. So the amount of simulation is getting longer, the accuracy is getting higher. Just in sort of the base cold or the base non-magnetic case, you can start probing pretty accurately the in-spiral merger and then the possible properties of the post-merger phase, which I'll say a bit more about in a bit. So the two results there are with the SACR code from Kyuchi and all at in Japan, and then there's some nice long waveforms from recent results from the WISCI code by Luciano and people who are some of them here, there's also been some nice improvements to the quasi-equilibrium sequences in the initial data that are used for binary neutron stars. So this is actually something that seems to be looking like a lot of improvement over the last few years. So if you looked at the initial data for binary neutron stars just a few years ago, it was really only accurate to kind of 1p in order. And you had fairly dramatic changes in the sort of observed angular momentum or whatnot after you started the simulation, and things kind of relaxed to the more relativistic configuration. And now people are going past the conformal flatness approximation, which for two things moving apart very far away is relevant. And so this is actually, it looks like the initial data for neutron stars is improving quite a lot in the recent years. Another thing that sort of results of the last year or so is Bruno's work looking at the actual measurability of the effects of magnetic fields on the in-spiral of neutron stars. So this is this nice result that for the purposes of looking at, say, the match between an in-spiral with and without magnetic fields, you really need to go to unphysical magnetic fields of 10 to the 17 or so before you see an impact. And that's actually close to the point where the magnetic field would actually destabilize the matter itself, and the star would, the equation of state at least would no longer be accurately describing whatever the hell was going on in there. So I have some stuff that was looking at the measurability of the equation of state itself in the latent and spiral. So using this idea of systematically varying the equation of the state of the neutron star and seeing if you could extract information from the latent spiral based on that. And this does seem to be giving a measurable or potentially measurable effect on the in spiral. And, oh, darn, this slide has cut off. So, okay, so, and then there's two nice recent results that I would also like to mention with the conformally flat Spooth particle hydrodynamics code. So the first one is modeling the effect of fully thermal equations of state on the waveform, and looking mostly at the post-merger phase, but also you can compare the in-spiral given the approximation and show that the effect is insignificant within the approximation. And this is looking at the difference between taking the degeneracy pressure, the cold equation of state that we have a wide zoo of, and adding an effective thermal part for what happens when stuff starts smashing together and creating heat and shock heating and stuff like that. And you can do this sort of ad hoc combination of an effective thermal part and some arbitrary cold equation of state. And the other thing that you can do is actually there's a couple of equations of state which are really fully thermal and that they're actually modeling how the matter would produce heat and how the pressure would change with respect to the temperature. So this is the Latimer-Swesty and the Shin equations of state. So these simulations compared the kind of the approximate scheme with the full thermal effect scheme and show that not unexpectedly, since everything stays cold in the in-spiral, it doesn't affect the in-spiral, but I'll show a result for the post-merger stuff later, which is also kind of appealing from the idea of a simple parameterization of what's going on in this kind of system. And the result that's cut off is this the same authors looking at this idea of the merger of strange stars, which is, you know, kind of cool because everyone loves strange quark matter. And in this case, the real advantage of the smooth particle hydrodynamics is if you have this kind of self-bound quark star, you have a very abrupt boundary between the high pressure of the quark matter and the vacuum surrounding it. So this is actually a real challenge for a hydrodynamic code to try and resolve this really abrupt transition. And smooth particle hydrodynamics can do this better, so they can actually look at what the magnitude of the differences might be. Okay, so I'm only going to present some waveform results because I'm sorry, Bruno. I know you have a very beautiful movie that you wanted me to show, but I'm going to run out of time entirely, I think, if we do that. But you know, you can ask Bruno if you want to see it, or I have it on my computer too. But anyway, so here's some examples of the kind of waveforms that you can start to get out of this range of parameter space that people are exploring now. This is a kind of an interesting example because this is the in-spiral. This is the peak frequency of the in-spiral, and this is the merger. This red region here is the two stars smashing together. And then stuff keeps happening, right? So you have this huge, long, it's this hypermassive remnant where differential rotation and thermal pressure can support the star in a bigger mass than would be sustainable by that given equation of state in equilibrium. And so this kind of bar mode or quadrupole mode object gives what might actually be significant gravitational radiation past the in-spiral part itself. This kind of signal, though, is very sensitive to a lot of effects that we don't really consider at all resolved in numerical simulations yet. So the details of the hydrodynamics can make a big difference into how long this kind of thing lasts. And there can also be amplification of magnetic field effects, which Bruno also showed, in the merger phase, which also affects the stability of this kind of object. So this sort of thing is an example, but this is also something where the uncertainties are a lot bigger here than they are in the in-spiral. So this is a sampling of results for somewhat larger mass neutron stars, where instead of having this this hypermassive remnant oscillating for a period of time afterwards, you get a fairly prompt collapse to a black hole. These are some really nice accurate simulations where you have the kind of the in-spiral thing, and then you have this dip, and this is roughly the sort of the ring down frequency that you have at the top here. And you'll notice that this also does not look like a binary black hole. Even though we're saying prompt collapse to black hole, trying to do a naive binary black hole in spiral merger ring down kind of modeling of this is not going to get you something that has anything like the right amplitude. So matter is really smearing out and changing things a lot in this merger region. This is something that, as yet, there's not really an analytic or sort of toy model understanding of exactly what's going on, but this is something that people are starting to look at as a characterization of the waveform. This is the thermal result that I talked about. So this is kind of interesting because it depends kind of on the underlying equation of state how significant the additional thermal component is going to be. So for example, in this case, which I think is Shen, you have the black curve is the actual full merger peak. So here you have something like an in-spiral, and then this is a post-merger oscillation, which has a peak frequency at depending on the equation of state and other factors. So this is the effect of thermal contributions on the frequency of the kind of post-merger oscillation that you saw in the first example. Okay.
Sorry, if you go back, which one was the hybrid, the cold plus
thermal? The way they did this is actually the red and green are two variants of the hybrid, and they vary the thermal index, the gamma, the describing the thermal part. Presumably, if you got your gamma tuned to match the realistic behavior, you could actually use the hybrid kind of cold plus thermal thing to get reasonable spectra, at least. I don't know how good it is for phasing or anything like that. And then, of course, here's the real one. This is something with an effective thermal index that's maybe a bit too low, and this one is a bit too high. And you see the effect that has on the peak. Yeah, and that's what the black curve takes into account. So the black curve has gamma depending on composition and density. The red and green ones are the effective one. Okay, so this is my, anything like this is subject to a lot of interpretation, but this is sort of the way I feel about the state of binary neutron star simulations. So I think we have the in-spiral physics under control. I think we have a pretty good understanding when we've tested things that we didn't think would make a huge difference to the in-spiral, they don't make a huge difference to the in-spiral. It's still, of course, conceivable that there's some effect that we've somehow managed to miss entirely, but it seems like we've got all the physics there. The issue in modeling neutron star in-spiral is really a question of resolution and numerical accuracy and kind of quantifying this, where the neutron star simulations, I think, are not at the level of precision of a black hole simulation. And part of this is the challenge in modeling the hydrodynamics at the same time. And the kind of the neutron star surface discontinuities, I guess, actually make it hard to get higher order simulations for these sort of things. At least right now, the order of convergence of this sort of thing is really limited by the hydrodynamics. Merger, I wouldn't say we have a quantitative understanding, but I think the qualitative understanding of what can happen is kind of robust. So there's this picture from 2006 from Shibata and Taniguchi, and I think it's relatively it's relatively the same. So the actual precise masses that are going to tell you the threshold mass where you get a prompt collapse to a black hole or whether you get a hypermassive neutron star. That's going to depend on the equation of state, but typically for, you know, different equations of state, this dividing mass varies, but the general characteristic behavior is the same. So here you have the impact on the mass ratio on the kind of torus formation, which I'm not going to talk too much about, but this, again, relatively robust understanding of what's going on over the last few years with additional simulations. So there haven't been any big upset surprises. In terms of the merger, you can also, people can talk about some sort of robust waveform characteristics, which describe maybe the spectrum or the general characteristics. And so some useful things to talk about are the frequency at the maximum amplitude at the end of M-spiral. So where the two stars, well, basically smash into each other, that frequency, not surprisingly, depends on how big they are. The peak frequency of a post-merger oscillation, if it occurs, is another sort of parameter that you can start to compare between simulations, equations of state, and stuff like that. And then you have the amplitude and duration of these possible post-merger oscillations, which is, I personally think something that's going to be a lot trickier to pin down, but we can at least start, you know, throwing numbers around and actually starting to compare them. So I think this is next. Okay, so now I'm going to talk a little bit about recent work, just because this is something that I've been talking to a lot of people here about. And so this is the neutron star version of Samurai. So I guess these are, you know, bigger, fatter Samurai that do more interesting things when they smash together, by my biased perspective. So we have a code comparison now, and this is kind of the initial setup here. So the equations that we have, I'm actually just going to mostly focus on HB and B because I'm just presenting some picture results, not actual numbers yet. But so we have some variation of the waveform. We're now going beyond just a single parameter variation of the waveform and looking at variation of not only the pressure scale but the gamma. And so we can also start sort of testing, like, these two equations of state have different gamma but the same lambda. These ones have about the same radius. We can start disentangling just what's the important parameter to describe what happens in the waveform. We're doing a equal mass binary. This is sort of based on the observed neutron stars in binaries. There's about 10 of these systems that we know of now, and the masses are measured quite precisely. So I think the canonical numbers, there's a conference proceedings by Nice and Stairs and one other person where they say that there's one 1.35 solar mass object that's something that's been spun up by accretion, I think, and there's another 1.30 average object. But typically, the masses range from 1.2 to 1.5. And so the mass ratio that we have to work with is a lot smaller. And we're starting out just with the equal mass case, so we don't have infinitely many parameters to worry about. So where are we in terms of code agreement? This is sort of the nice case. This was a low resolution run, and these are two high resolution runs with two different codes. And we actually realized afterwards that they're actually testing, one of them has an effective thermal part and one of them doesn't, but you can't tell the difference here. So that's sort of a good sign for the fact that we don't think the thermal part is significant for the N-spiral. To line these up, I've taken the peak amplitude of the waveform and extracted the time and phase of that single point and just aligned them all by that single point. So there's not matching here. This is actually the fact that these agree back this well back to the beginning is sort of, I mean, it's not optimized at least. There's still some fuzziness in where exactly the peak amplitude is because of residual eccentricity, but I'm ignoring that for now. Things are a little less good in this other case. Again, we still match just at a peak amplitude point. And there's some sort of a systematic difference between the waveforms that we don't quite understand. But one thing that we do think is nice is that we compare some waveforms with starting with large initial separations, and some waveforms, I don't know if you can see the black ones, starting with small initial separations. And we at least think that the initial data is not a significant phase accumulation effect after they start. So that's nice, again, looking at the agreement. What actually was maybe more surprising was the agreement after the peak of the N-spiral. So maybe the collapse to black hole case, we're pretty confident that's resolved in the, as usual, the merger is the easiest to resolve, and it's really hard to kind of preserve angular momentum when things are far apart and moving quick. There's some amplitude difference between the two codes, but the frequency and the length of this prompt collapse kind of thing are the same. So, okay, that's maybe better than we would have expected. And the really kind of interesting thing is this long, hypermassive post-merger oscillation. We expected these to be like totally different from each other. We didn't think we were resolving the merger at all well. But we actually, just by matching at this one point, these two waveforms never go fully out of phase for the whole period of simulation. So this is not the full thing. This is truncated at a given point. But that was a bit of a surprise, and I guess it means that probably we're doing better with the hydrodynamics and the shocks and the stuff in terms of the impact on a broad macro-scale gravitational waveform than we feared. So, I mean, maybe there's issues of precisely resolving the shocks, and this was probably important for stability, but in terms of actually looking at the waveform, it's not as significant as we were worrying about. So that's, you know, a sort of intermediate status update that's promising for this. I can also show spectra. So from the initial overview plots I showed you at the beginning, I've zoomed in on the bottom right corner down. This is the same mass scale. So this whole chunk here has SNR of about 2 in this broadband. So this is high power detuned, if I have my terminology right, advanced LIGO configuration. So, I mean, you're not going to probably be resolving that, but there's space here to resolve it. And if you overlay the ones with short initial data, the amplitude at least is agreeing. And you can also see the impact of the low resolution on the amplitude is really during the in-spiral phase. So this one is an example of a run with low resolution compared to two runs with higher resolution, and it's sort of falling off. So I think at this point, without thinking about it a lot, I think right away we can say that we kind of understand what the waveforms are going to be like from about this point, and then and actually the frequencies of the peaks and the merger. Some of these are truncated earlier than others, so the amplitude is not necessarily significant, but the fact that the frequencies agree is a good sign. Okay. So I also give in... I've totally been ignoring your signs, haven't I? Which I can't even read that. Oh, 5. Ha, nice. Okay. So this is something that probably a lot of you have seen before. So this is something I was showing a few years ago, talking about some first runs we had trying to get at least an order of magnitude estimate of what the departure from post-Newtonian can be. And, you know, now I look back on it and I wonder how, you know, I really thought I could do anything with this kind of data. So this is the update, basically. The nice thing is that qualitatively the features don't seem to change. One thing is that if you match earlier in the in-spiral, you actually separate the waveforms out earlier. Okay, this just means basically, again, these particular plots are all matches to point particle, totally ignoring the first half of this talk. But as a conservative estimate of differences, that's sort of the one you can do. So when you have more of the in spiral and you match to a point particle, you match earlier, that's matching, that means that the chunk you had before was not the start of the effect of the equation of state or numerical resolution, but I'm hoping at least most of it is the equation of state. Okay. So this is nice. So this previous one, we had a result that if you also were looking at the perturbative estimate, might have been sort of confusing, because when we did the estimates with the numerical simulations, we were getting that radius is measured to plus or minus a kilometer, that these two equations of state were marginally distinguishable at a reasonable distance at advanced LIGO. And if you remember the post-Newtonian waveform thing, these two things were totally indistinguishable in advanced LIGO. And so this is really an issue of what frequency range of the signal we're using. So in this one, in the numerical simulations, we're assuming the estimate sort of assumes identical waveforms before the start of numerical simulation. So it's really only valid above 700 hertz or more. And then this one is only valid beneath 450 hertz, because that's where we cut off the integration. And so there's some additional effects intermediate, which would also cause differences in SNR. And also you can kind of add the delta SNR and these two things together, sort of, plus whatever's happening in the middle. So that gives you the idea of these, the sort of relative importance of these regimes. So only for no realistic equation of state is this regime important for advanced LIGO, but this one is, and if you think about trying to stitch the two things together, the intermediate regime is definitely going to be important. So for an example of that, if you put in the tidal lambda of the largest radius simulated waveform, it actually gives a phase accumulation relative to point particle or another equation of state of more than 2 pi somewhere between 450 hertz and the start of simulations. So you can't just, I mean, if you just had the leading order thing and you try and map it through to the simulation, you've already got this guy is decoherent through the entire simulation. All the SNR difference is dominated by the early in spiral part that you can only touch with post-Newtonian. Okay. So this is sort of, for really a robust quantitative estimate, this is a problem. There's some imminent improvements. So we have improved simulations. Those start to tell us some more. And you know, in principle, we can just throw computing time and resolution at it until the end of time. But there's also the alternate side. There's the next leading order piece, the most significant piece that's sort of making us stop the integration at 450 hertz for the perturbative thing, is the next, the post-Newtonian correction to the tidal potential that you're putting your perturbed star in. So that actually, by 450 hertz, can give you about a 10% change in what your phase effect is. So really, if you want to push that to higher frequency, you want to actually pin down what the number on that next order term is going to be. And the caveat there is that there are also other effects that are maybe not so well described. So as the stars spiral together, the frequency of their orbit can start approaching fundamental resonant frequencies of the stars individually. So that bleeds off energy into resonant excitations of the matter that would also accelerate the in-spiral. So we're pushing these things together, but I don't think there's not a clear picture of how to get a robust overlap where we have really confident understanding of both methods where we can really test them against each other. So there's some sort of gap in our understanding of physics there. So one thing is, okay, well can we tune our in-spiral model with the numerical results? Can we do a sort of a phenomenological description of the waveform, add some higher order terms that we don't know but should in principle be there and might be significant, and then fit the numerical data to that and see if we can get good agreement? So this is the result using the EOB framework that Alessandro Nagar is working on, using one of these very, very long gamma equals 2 polytrope in spiral results. And so what I want to point out at this slide is basically this. So you have sort of this tidal potential here, and you just add some higher order terms with arbitrary coefficients onto it that you're going to fit with your numerical simulation data, and they effectively amplify the tidal effects. You can also see this if you try and compare a post-Newtonian or EOB estimate of the binding energy in a quasi-equilibrium system, and you look at the departures of that from the point particle. You can see this amplification of the energy going into deformation beyond what you would expect from leading order in a reasonable separation. And so you can actually get pretty nice fits with this kind of procedure. So this is, one thing I want to point out is that you probably can't see with these labels, but this is two simulations with the same equation of state, different masses, and the same parameters fitting it for both masses. So the mass coefficient of the leading order tidal term is the one that's being put in here, and then just some additional parameters to sort of say how much you amplify, and that's enough to fit both. Which, I mean, okay, you have two parameters and two simulations, maybe you're not yet convinced, but this is at least promising that we can sort of modify EOB or modify some other post-Newtonian approximant and create some sort of hybrid thing. But there is a caveat here. And I guess this is maybe something similar to what you've seen in the black hole case with trying to look at spins. Because if you just fit these coefficients to the data, it actually can disrupt, to use the terminology of yesterday, the agreement between the corrected and the point particle thing and the early in spiral. So this amplification gives you bigger effects than actually that error estimate of when you could cut off the leading order calculation predicted. Excuse me. So I wouldn't say that we are yet. So the phase match is very good, and so the agreement of parameters between the two is very nice, but I think it would be good to have more understanding of this intermediate frequency regime for making kind of quantitative estimates of how much the waveform is going to change due to matter, and that's actually my last slide. So thank you.
Great, Christian. Thanks, Jocelyn. So, any questions?
It's going to be a discussion session, right?
Yeah, but that's not just my talk.
Should we start with the discussion right away?
If there's specific questions about the talk, maybe we'll take those and then we'll broaden the discussion.
Well, I have several, actually, but we can. We can start with one. One thing that is not, I hope not to upset the EOB church here, but why can't you do this sort of calculation by using a standard post-Newtonian framework and try to compute the next two leading order in tidal deformations that way?
You can. So I'm working on that. I don't have pretty plots yet. In principle, in terms of comparison to black holes,
And also, Jocelyn, while you're discussing this, one thing that I think I told you some time ago, I'm a little afraid in all these estimates of tidal parameters that even though the spins for neutron stars are expected to be small, there could be a degeneracy between parameters when you do Fisher matrix estimates.
Oh, yeah, yeah, definitely. So, I mean, we expect that lambda is kind of the leading parameter, but definitely, I mean, and this is something we can in principle test with the new simulations covering a wider array of parameter space. So this is specifically why we started to vary multiple parameters on the underlying equation of state. So the idea about this is that we actually have this equation of state parameter space where we are trying to figure out basically what you know, surfaces of waveform departure have some perpendicular parameter, which is you know, characterizing the leading effect, sort of like chirp mass or something. And then you have additional parameters that would, you know, modify based on where you are. And the hope is that lambda, as the post-Newtonian parameter that describes the leading order tidal effect, is going to be this appropriate parameter to describe the space. But that's not something we assume it now, but we're also testing it. There is some indication that if you look at the late in spiral, where you really do expect nonlinear deformation and higher order deformation to be significant, lambda is still empirically, things that are close in lambda look closer in the late in spiral too. So nothing quantitative yet, but at least it's not the wrong thing to do. And definitely you want to see, like, whether, say, radius or lambda or something else entirely is the most significant predictor of how the waveform behaves. To the other point, I mean, in a sense, since hydrodynamics is so important for binary neutron stars, they get so smeared out, and that they actually, I mean, so you can see here, so this is the black hole case compared to, this is Frank and Lucia's phenomenological waveform amplitude, just to give a representation of what the black hole, binary black hole waveform is. This is the amplitude of just the Taylor 3.0, 3.35, blah, 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 point particle kind of amplitude. And you seem to get kind of, I mean, this is only amplitude, but you seem to get kind of robust differences. So you're really measuring departures from point particle in a relatively low frequency regime, where you would think probably a standard post-Newtonian expansion is better than in the black hole case. So, yeah.
So, Emmanuel, regarding your first question, so I'm involved in that work with Alessandro Nagar and Baiotti after his simulation were done by Luca Baiotti using Whiskey. And so we tried also to use the standard post-Newtonian with next little order, but for example, one difference is that, as Jocelyn told before, in the case of UOB, the same coefficients give a very good agreement in the two cases. While in the case of the standard tailored for whatever post-Newtonian approximation, we had to use two different coefficients in order to match very well the two different simulations. So it looks that it seems that the UOB is a bit more robust. But, I mean, these are really preliminary results, so I don't want to...
I'm a little surprised because these effects are relatively early in the in spiral, and so I don't... Anyway, we can talk about it later.
May I ask a question since I have the mic? So you were showing, for example, in the waveform in which... So we were showing the difference of thermal effects in the waveform, that you were showing that these effects are important in frequency between 2 and 4 kilohertz, more or less. And this is something that I think we already know. And we know also that we want to see effects, for example, from the magnetic fields. We need to have a look at the hypermassive neutron stars, which means having a look at frequency around 2 and 4 kilohertz, more or less. So are advanced LIGO and Virgo completely out of the game about observing difference at this frequency, and do we really need Einstein telescope, or there is still some hope about, I don't know, some narrow band configuration, advanced LIGO and Virgo being able to catch some effects at these high frequencies?
Yeah, so, okay, so this is one of the narrow band advanced LIGO configurations. If I recall correctly, you can you know, play games with the parameters of the detector simulation to push this up to something like 300 or 3,000 hertz without too much loss in the dip. The whole SNR that we're playing with is not so huge, though. So the whole SNR of this blue curve in this gray noise is about 2. So I don't know how much that will help. I mean, another caveat, though, is that the distance scale can change. The amplitude of these peaks can change depending on how long-lasting the particular post-merger oscillation that you observe is. I don't think we have a really robust number for that yet. So, I mean, I haven't actually, you know, tried to calculate the SNR of this really, this one. You know, that might actually be enough cycles. The amplitude is kind of low, but it might be enough cycles that you actually pick up something significant. So I wouldn't say that you can necessarily ignore it. I think doing some sort of, you know, Matter Ninja style thing, like Christian is probably going to talk about in the discussion, I'm sure, with this kind of injected waveform for kind of a burst search was definitely interesting. Just calculating the raw SNR of things, it's again borderline, you know, one SNR or two or something.
Actually, since I'm holding the mic, I'm going to ask a question. You mentioned at the start that more and more physical effects are being put in, and part of the reason is to try and see electromagnetic signatures. And some people have suggested maybe these will give off radio signatures before merger, or they're responsible for GRBs, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Is any of this coming out of the code yet, and is there a hope that it will?
Well, so probably Bruno could answer this better than I could. So I know for the GRB formation scenario, the thing that people talk about now is the torus big enough to power this? I mean, you're not directly putting... Luis is raising his hand. I don't think you're... Are you directly putting in the electromagnetic production, or...?
No, we're not there yet, but, I mean, things like the size of the torus, the configuration, the fallback material that comes after the merger, so these are things that maybe SAC will cover. But, yeah, slowly these things are being put in.
As to before the merger, I don't think... So there's some sort of idea that, like, you have crust cracking or you know disruption of stuff on the edges of the neutron star. That's actually quite low frequency, below 100 or much lower than that, if I remember correctly. And so so that's not something that's really in the applicability range of these full numerical simulations. But you can definitely conceive of simulating something with an effect of potential from the other body or something like that to look at that question.
Just a quick practical question. You mentioned on one of the slides that you were taking the spin of the neutron stars into account when and marginalizing over it. And I was actually a little bit surprised that it even matters for this calculation. So how large do you expect the spins to be, and how strong is the effect of the spins on the tidal effects?
So let me see if I can remember. It isn't large. The spins are small. They're very. I mean, well, it's. I think you put in numbers to the post-Newtonian evolution that end up being sort of factors of thousands or so smaller than anything you would put in for sort of a medium spinning black hole. So this is done with Tanya's code, and I'm trying to remember exactly the Poisson and someone method. Poisson and Will have this initial paper where they marginalized over spin too. Since this is a late in spiral thing and the spin would be more significant there, it was marginalized over it. And I'm trying to remember. I mean, it didn't have. It didn't blur your delta lambda by more than a 50%, if I recall, but I would have to check that to be sure. But yeah, it does make some difference. Not as much as the mass ratio, but some.
Any more questions? Okay. I guess we can open up. We have now sort of, we can flow into the half-hour discussion session, which can be about whatever people feel.